Our scripture this morning is going to be taken from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 7, verses 1 through 10, if you would care to follow along. Now, when he had ended all his sayings in the audience of the people, he entered into Capernaum. And a certain centurion servant, who was dear unto him, was sick and ready to die. And when he heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying, This was worthy for whom he should do this, for he loveth our nation, and hath built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with them, and when he was now not far from the house, a centurion sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that thou shouldest enter under my roof. Wherefore neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee, but say in a word, and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers, and I say unto one, Go, and he goeth. And to another, come and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turned unto him, and said unto the people that followed him, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And they went that were sent, returning to the house, found the servant whole, that he had been sick.
Good morning. Starting a series of sermons today out of the book of Luke. In fact, we're going to do a lot out of Luke over the next 20 weeks or so. We're going to do four or five lessons out of Luke right now. We're going to take a break and do something out of Colossians. Then we're going to come back and do about 10 in a row out of Luke on a different theme. And so if you can't find Luke in your Bible, today's a good day to mark that because we're going to be there for a while and there's lots of good things to learn. The series title is Jesus and the Weak, and I wasn't sure exactly how to title it. I struggled. Maybe weak is not the best word, but Jesus and the Needy didn't sound quite right either. The word needy kind of has a negative connotation to it. These are stories in the book of Luke where someone comes to Jesus with a need or a problem or challenge that they simply don't have the strength to overcome themselves. They are weak, at least in respect to this situation. And the question we're going to have throughout is, how does Jesus interact with this people, and how does God respond to this weakness? And what we're going to find is Luke is giving us these stories, not just to give us a story about someone who happened to be weak that day, but to help all of us realize that all of us, the human creature, lives in a state of perpetual weakness. That we have in front of us tasks that are simply too large for us to tackle. That if we're in charge of doing this on our own, we're in a lot of trouble. Some days we notice that and some days we don't. Some days we're really good at forgetting it and thinking we have the power to master the universe and to order our lives in such a way that everything will go the way that it does and it's supposed to and the way that we want. And then some days, like the days we're going to read about in these stories, events in life remind us that that's just not true. That we have a lot of free will that we can exercise and influence the world around us, but there are limitations to what we can accomplish. There are problems that we don't always have the power to overcome. God does not save us because we are so powerful. He saves us in our state of weakness. He comes to us in our state of need and responds to that. And these stories tell us about Jesus doing exactly that in the lives of individual people. This particular story in Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 10, is going to discuss a man who had an illness. Now, certainly, if you've ever been ill, and not just ill, but severely ill, to the point of death ill, you know the feeling of helplessness that you have in that moment. You are in need. You are in weakness. However, as I studied the story isn't really very much about sickness. There's lots of stories in the Bible where Jesus heals somebody that's sick, but that's not what Luke talks about. In fact, the person who is sick is actually a secondary character in the story. We never even meet him. Jesus never even meets the person who's sick. The person who's sick is in a house somewhere else. Jesus hears about him. Jesus travels towards him. He never gets there. And the man is healed without ever coming in contact with Jesus. He's what makes the story work, but he's not the character that makes the story meaningful to us. The character that we encounter that shows us the weakness we have to learn about happens to be a soldier. I'd like to tell you that I was just that clever and I planned a story about a centurion on Memorial Weekend. It happened entirely by accident and I didn't notice till this morning. But as it turns out, it is a story about Jesus interacting with a very admirable Roman soldier on this occasion. And it's the soldier, the centurion, who plays the main role in this particular story. The story is about worth and trying to ascertain worth. What are you worth? All of us would like to have a really good answer to that question. And how you answer that question actually tells us and tells yourself a lot about you. If you answer in dollars, then more than likely you are demonstrating a quality the Bible calls covetousness, where you measure your personal worth in terms of dollars and cents and possessions. The things that I have is what I'm worth. And certainly a big chunk of our world measures their worth in that way. And it's probably the most common. If you say, what are you worth? We think net worth. We think, let me get a ledger out and tell you. If you say, let me tell you about my accomplishments. What am I worth? How important am I? We might answer that by saying, well, here are the things that I've done. What we're essentially saying is, the world wouldn't be the same if I weren't in it. That's what I'm worth. And what you're demonstrating is a characteristic the Bible calls pride, where you say, this is what makes me worthwhile. Look at what I have done. If you answer that question in social status, what are you worth? Well, let me tell you, I'm an important guy around here. If that's the way you answer that question, you are delusional. Because that's not even as real as the possessions, at least the money I can count. Social status is imaginary, and quite often not even true. What do people think about you? Do you think you know? Do you think you know? I'm not asking what they tell you they think about you. I'm asking what they think about you. If you measure your self-worth based on social status, you are delusional. Because first of all, there's no such thing. Second of all, you have no idea what it is. And not only that, it is the most temporary thing you're likely to find. Ask a former politician. Right? When you have power and social status, everyone wants to talk to you. What about when they find out you're not running for anything? No one needs you, right? You're unimportant. Social status, delusional. If you answer with nothing, and a lot of people in this world do, we have lived in a world that is steeped in despair, who simply have no answer to that question. They couldn't find it in possessions or money. They couldn't find it in accomplishments. They couldn't find it in social networking. And so they just look at their life and they say, I don't know that I'm worth anything. And when you talk to people who suffer from critical depression, that's often the conversation that you end up having. Well, why do you feel this way about yourself? Well, just look at my life. I don't have anything. I haven't done anything. No one cares that I exist. Dollars, accomplishments, and social status. That they're looking for the answer in all the wrong places. They don't find the answer there. And so they live in a state of despair. And that's a real challenge. It's more complicated than that. I'm giving you the Reader's Digest version. But this is the simple approach. If you answer with nothing, if you have no answer, I don't know if I'm worth anything at all, then it's really hard to keep on living. It's really hard to keep off despair. This is a story about personal worth, and that's the question at the heart of the way Luke tells this story. Read it verse by verse and see if that's not the case. The first question that really comes out, what is a slave worth? In verse 1 through 3, it reads like this. After we have finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him the elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. What is a servant worth? I notice I have the word slave up there. Your text may have the word slave. It may have the word servant. It's really hard to give you an apples for apples comparison of what this person's status was in their world and how that parallels are. I don't think, this is Ben's think so, I don't think that it's the same as, like in America, we had colonial slavery, what's sometimes called chattel slavery, where the person is literally just a piece of property. I don't think that is the situation here. However, neither is it like the current American economy, where you work for someone by free will and you can quit when you want to, right? It's not that either. Somewhere in between those is this idea of a bondservant, of a person who's not a possession, but neither is he entirely free. In a world of delusional social rankings, this person's delusional social ranking is much lower down the ladder than the person he works for. He doesn't have the same layer of rights. In American culture, we just take it for granted. In fact, around the world, because of American culture, people take it for granted that a person should be of the same worth wherever they rank in society. That's an idea, that's a fairly modern idea. By the way, it comes from Christianity, but that's a sermon for another day. The idea is fairly modern. The ancient world, that was not taken for granted. Of course, a more wealthy person is more important than a poorer person. Of course, a master is more important than a slave. What's a slave worth? In the ancient world, a person looked at a slave or a servant, and they were down the ladder somewhere. You didn't go to extraordinary lengths to help out a person in that situation because they just weren't important enough, except in Luke chapter 7. In Luke chapter 7, we're introduced to this centurion. He's a Roman. By all guesswork, there's no reason to believe he's Jewish, which is very fascinating for this story. He's probably not Jewish. He is a foreign soldier stationed in this particular place called Capernaum. He's a centurion. He has power and authority and probably some residence and some personal worth and some status. And he has servants. He has these bondservants that work for him and attend to his household. How does he view his servant? He doesn't view him as a possession. He doesn't really even seem to view him as several rungs down the ladder. How does he treat him? He's willing to go to extraordinary lengths to help this man out. And you see that in the text. It says it in verse 2, who was highly valued by him. The centurion values the person, not the commodity, the person who is the servant. But then it's not enough just to say, oh, I value you very much. Try that sometimes. Go to your spouse and say, oh, you're very important to me. Then don't act like it. Doesn't get you very far, right? This man doesn't just say, I value you very much. He then acts on it. He goes to extraordinary lengths when this man is sick. How do I know he goes to extraordinary lengths? Because Jesus isn't a doctor. You're a Roman centurion with power and wealth. Someone's sick, what's your first call? It's not Jesus of Nazareth. Why is he calling Jesus of Nazareth? And by the way, he doesn't just call Jesus, he doesn't call anybody. Well, he doesn't just speak to Jesus of Nazareth. How does he do it? He gathers the local Jewish elders and sends an envoy on his behalf to go reach out to a person he has no relationship with to ask a favor. He calls in his chips, right? He's owed favors in the community, and he goes to the Jewish elder and he says, I need a favor now. I'm trading in my chips. I need you to go to this Jesus of Nazareth. So let me ask you, you're a wealthy, powerful Roman official. At what point do you call in the local witch doctor? We don't think of Jesus as a witch doctor, but you're a Roman person. And there's this Jewish person traveling the countryside. He's not part of Jewish leadership. He's not a Pharisee. He's not a Sadducee. He's not a priest. But he cast out demons and has a reputation. This reeks of desperation, right? Jesus isn't the first person you call in this situation. If you're a Roman, I would have to think Jesus is the last person you call. But he calls him. He gets people to go ask on his behalf. Go bring Jesus and have him come help. What does that tell you? Now, he would do that for his son, right? Well, who do you have desperation for? If your child is sick, yeah, you go find the faith healer. You go find anybody you can find because your child's sick. Do you do it for somebody who's that far beneath you? Only if you value them as if they're not far beneath you. This soldier is a remarkable person. He's a person in authority. He's not Jewish. And yet he sees a servant as a person of value. And he's willing to go to extraordinary lengths to help this person out. And to prove my point, contrast that with verse 4, because that's not how the Jewish leaders think. Look in verse 4. And when they, this is the Jewish elders, when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him." Who's he? They're asking Jesus, come heal the centurion's servant. He is worthy of you doing this thing. Who's he? It's not the servant. Read verse 5. For he loves our nation, and he is one who built us our synagogue. Read that carefully. They're not saying, this servant is a great person, you should come heal him. They are saying, the centurion is a great man, you should do this favor for him. The servant figures not into their equation at all. They have nothing to say about the servant. They've probably never met the servant. They don't care. They're not doing this because a servant is sick. They are doing it because of the centurion asked. Who do they value? They value the centurion. Which, by the way, is its own point. Just to comment one more time about how remarkable the centurion is in this passage. Think of this story, transplant it 2,000 years and put it in Iraq or Afghanistan. And it's an American lieutenant. And one of his privates, one of his soldiers, or maybe one of his servants, household servants or something, I don't know, it doesn't really parallel well, is ill, and he needs a request. And he asks the local Islamic leaders to go and find someone who can come and help. This is a strange story, isn't it? And if you were to parallel that into modern culture, it's hard to even imagine how it would work. But then what do they say about him? He loves our nation. He built our synagogue. He's not Jewish. There's no indication in the text that a Roman centurion would be Jewish. But he's loving, he's compassionate, he's generous. He gave the funds that built the synagogue. Again, can you imagine a wealthy American lieutenant in Afghanistan building a local mosque, or a local wealthy Islamic person in Glenpool saying, coming to us and saying, I'd like to give you some funds to build you a new church building? Don't hold your breath, right? I mean, that's strange. And I want you to understand how strange this story is. This is a remarkable figure. Is it easy if you're a foreign soldier stationed in an unknown land to feel a little disdain for the people around you? To look down on them? You're the reason I'm here, you troublemaking Jewish folk. You're the reason I'm here and not back home. But he treats them with kindness, capacity for love. He's generous. He's not even Jewish, but he'll say, I'll pay for your synagogue. Because it will keep everybody happy. He's a nice guy. And so the local Jewish elders value him a great deal. This is a man who's worthy of you doing this. But they have nothing to say about the slave. The slave can't do anything for them. The centurion can. But listen further. Again, look at the character of this man and the notion of worth in the verses that follow, beginning in verse 6. What does the centurion think about himself? In verse 6, we read this passage. And Jesus went with them. And when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Look again at the sharp distinction. The elders of the Jewish religion go to Jesus and say, this is a powerful, important man. He loves our nation. He's been good to us. He's built our synagogue. He's worthy of your help. Come do this as a favor to us, because we owe a favor to him. The centurion says, oh, no, no, I don't want to trouble the man. I'm not worthy to have this man under my roof. This is backwards. Okay? The wealthy person demonstrates his wealth by having lesser people come in and showing them hospitality. So if this is a great man and Jesus is a lesser man, what the centurion should say is, come in and enjoy my largesse. Come in and let me show you hospitality and wealth and prosperity and greatness, and you can show me honor. That's not what he says, because he doesn't consider Jesus to be a lesser person. He says, not only is he not lesser, he's not even equal. I'm not worthy for him to come under my roof. What kind of person does the centurion think himself to be? What kind of person does the centurion think Jesus to be? What kind of a man does a soldier feel like he is unworthy of? Lieutenants don't salute me. Okay? Who do they honor? Superiors. You salute the superior. The centurion wouldn't even imagine inviting the emperor over for dinner, because he's not worthy of having the Roman emperor in his home. There's no way that works out. We won't even issue the invitation. And that's sort of the way he's treating Jesus. I'm not worthy to invite you into my home. This was not me attempting to bother you in any way. I have no right. Do you see how starkly different he views himself and he views the centurion as opposed to the Jewish elders do? This is a story about personal worth. The centurion, furthermore, values Jesus as one who holds the authority of heaven's God. Verse 7 and 8 are really peculiar. If you don't think like a soldier, think like a soldier, 7 and 8 makes all kinds of sense. If you don't, you're trying to figure out what's going on. Read 7 and 8. This is what he says to Jesus. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. Okay, first off in verse 7, I didn't presume to come to you. So the two things he doesn't presume here. I'm not worthy to have you under my roof, and I didn't personally come to you. Why not? Back in my salesman day, seemed like forever ago, one of the stores I worked at selling furniture when I was younger was Factory Direct Furniture, and the owner of that store is Roger Mathis. He's the guy you see in the commercials. And his office was actually in our store, even though he worked at several stores. And his name was Mathis, so that was enough, right? So you were supposed to stand up straighter when he walked by and so forth. How many times do you suppose I walked into his office to chat uninvited? He didn't do that. If I had a question, I didn't step into his office and say, hey, Roger, let me ask you something about this sofa over here. That's not the way it worked. If I had a question, I asked my boss, and my boss asked his boss, and his boss talked to Roger. Okay. And if Roger thought I was doing something wrong, he didn't tell me. He told his employee, who told his employee, who was my boss. And that's who told me, by the way, Ben, you're in trouble. See how this works? That's what the centurion is saying. I wouldn't even presume to come to you. The idea that I was important enough to walk up to you and start issuing demands, he says, never crossed my mind. I'm not worthy to have you under my roof, and I'm not important enough to bother you. And so he's apologizing. You catch? This is an apology to Jesus for troubling him. I've been a bother to you, and I didn't intend for that. He says, instead, what I expected you to do was to issue a command. That's what verse 8 is about. He says, because I'm a person under authority too, and I know how this works. I know that when you get authority from someone, that authority stands on its own two feet. When the centurion said, go that way, the troops went. You know why? Not because he was such a great person, although it seems that he was, but because when the centurion said, go, Caesar said, go. When a man in a commissioned office like that says something, he carries the weight of the top of the ladder to everybody underneath him on the ladder. He says, I'm a person under authority. Under authority. Right? I know who's above me. They give me my commands. I give me my commands, and those people do them, not because of me, but because of my authority. And he compares that to Jesus. What's his point? He recognizes, as a Gentile Roman official, as a soldier, he says, I recognize who you are and what you're doing. You are one under authority. And when you speak, it's like heaven speaks. When you speak, the God of Israel speaks. I don't need you to come to my house. I wouldn't bother you with that. I just thought you'd say a word and the God of heaven would heal my servant. See how remarkable that is? He's not expecting pageantry, no voodoo, no exorcism, no ritual. He says, "You have the authority of heaven in your hands. I thought you would just say a word. I didn't mean to bother you." You see the remarkable difference of how people view themselves in this story. We look at a servant, we see a servant. The Jewish leaders look at the servant, they see a servant. They look at a centurion, they see an important man. But when the centurion looks in the mirror, he sees a man who is only where he is because somebody told him to be there. He sees a man who has a job to do and he's doing it. He's a nice person. He's polite to others. He's generous. He's not worth anybody's trouble. And he sees Jesus not as a person to beg a favor of, but as a person with the authority of heaven who can say a word and heal a man at the point of death. And that's when something really strange happens in verse 9 of this story. Let me pause just a moment, though, because I forgot this line on the slide. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to preach the story of Naaman the leper. You ought to compare these two stories sometime. Naaman is also a soldier. He's a general. He's a Syrian general. And he himself is very, not a servant, he himself is sick with leprosy. And they tell him, go down here to Judah and visit Elisha. And Elisha, the prophet, sends out a servant. Sends out a servant and says, go over here in Jordan and wash 7 times and you'll be healed. And Naaman says, that's not the way this works. I am important. The prophet comes to me. He tells me what to do, and it better be flashy. It better be significant. It better be impressive. It better not be dirty old Jordan. And the servant reminds him, you know, if you could do this yourself, we wouldn't be here. Okay, that's the paraphrase version. Get the full version in a few weeks. There's a man who thinks a lot of himself and doesn't value the authority of heaven's God. This is the exact opposite. This is a man in authority who says, I value the power of heaven's God. I'm not worthy. I'll send the messengers. I'm not worthy for you to come to me. I'm not demanding that you come to me because I'm important. I'm not worthy for you to come to me. And Jesus, I think, knows both stories. And he does something in verse 9 that is really kind of amazing. Jesus is, in fact, amazed. Read verse 9, the very first part. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at them. Just pause there a moment. Read your four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Lots of people are surprised by lots of things. It's never Jesus. People see things that Jesus does and are amazed. Read the book of Acts. People see things the apostles do and are amazed. They are marveling. They are surprised and shocked and in awe. This is one of the only passages you'll ever find where Jesus himself says, now that's amazing. And what is it? Is it a miracle? No, Jesus is going to do one of those himself. That's not what amazes him. It's a person who understands his own weakness. A person who understands his own worth. A person who recognizes his place in relationship to other people, his place in relationship to a servant, his place in relationship to Jesus Christ and the God of Jesus Christ. He recognizes that relationship and Jesus says, that's amazing. And he's not even Jewish. Jesus follows that up by saying, I've not found so great a faith in all of Israel. I can't find any Israelites who get it. The proper understanding of yourself in relationship to God, Jesus says, that's called faith. And I'd like to find some more of that. Faith is what helps you to understand your own personal worth. Who you are in relationship to your God and what he's worth. And Jesus says, that's what I've been looking for. I hadn't found it until now. And it wasn't in a place you would have guessed. Jesus responds in verse 10. It's almost anticlimactic. The whole miracle story is over in one sentence in verse 10. They went home and he was healed. Done. Just the way the man said. Jesus didn't even go into the house. He went home, he was healed. It was over. Because Jesus is one who has the authority of heaven. Jesus responds to the recognition of weakness and of faith with the power of heaven itself. What's the storyline here? We suffer as humans from dual weaknesses. We have false notions of worth, delusions of grandeur. And then at the same time, we have crippling absence of worth. Because we have ourselves invested in all the wrong places and in all the wrong values, They can't sustain us, and so we suffer from crippling despair because we don't know who we are. We don't know that we're made in the image of God. We don't know how to relate to Him, and it cripples us inside and out. This story is a response to that kind of weakness that every human faces. And here is the answer the centurion and Jesus give us. Neither status, nor wealth, nor accomplishments give us worth, because the centurion had all of those and to spare. What gives a person value comes from the worth bestowed upon us by God and on others by us. Or to say it the way Jesus says it, the greatest commandments is to love the Lord your God and your neighbor as yourself. That's worth. Your worth is what is bestowed upon you by God and what you bestow upon others. When you understand that relationship, then things are ready to change. Then your weakness can be made strong in Christ Jesus. If you are a person who has not come to Christ Jesus, quite possibly the reason you have not is because you have not come to grips with your relationship to Him and the weakness that cripples your life. You aren't supposed to fix it. You're supposed to recognize it. You're supposed to know that you can't do this yourself. That if you want a life of meaning and value, it starts with faith that only the God of heaven can make that possible, that Jesus is His Son. And submitting to Him is a path to worth, to meaning, to value. When we submit to Him, He is able to lift us up and give us a life that matters. And if you've not put on Christ in baptism, or if there's some other need we can help you with, that's the proper response to the authority of heaven. As we stand and sing, won't you come at this time?